Well, the first thing I think he would do would be to stand up and tell the truth. I mean, he had a great expression that was just tell the truth and watch them scatter.
So the further away the problem is, the easier it is to postpone action on it. And that's essentially what we're doing.
Be real. Because people in New Hampshire are really cool.
I'd say get in the game. This is a problem facing your generation. You have to have a voice in the decision.
Welcome to Facing the Future, brought to you by the Concord Coalition on WKXL, New Hampshire's talk radio station. Tune in each week as we dive into topics related to fiscal policy, like healthcare, taxes, national security, the national debt, and more. You'll hear discussions with experts, elected officials, and industry leaders on how the nation's fiscal and economic challenges impact current and future generations, and we'll explore some of the solutions. I'm your host and New England Regional Director for the Concord Coalition, Chase Hageman. Today I'll be joined on the show by Phil Sletten, a policy analyst with the New Hampshire Fiscal Policy Institute. But before we dive into today's discussion, let's kick off the program with our first segment, Facing the News, where we will take a few minutes to see what is going on in the world of fiscal policy this week. The budget tracker for CQ Roll Call is reporting that policymakers will likely use a two-week recess to identify a strategy for wrapping up the fiscal year 2020 appropriations. The president signed a stopgap measure that will fund the government through November 21st, but what's next is quite uncertain. The fiscal year for 2019 just ended at the end of September 30th, and we're now already in fiscal year 2020. Conflicts concerning southern border wall funding, domestic spending levels, and even abortion policies have tied up the process. The Senate still has not passed any of its 12 bills. The House passed 10, but many have to be rewritten because they exceed newly set spending levels on the heels of the bipartisan budget deal enacted in August. Preliminary talks have not revealed any obvious breakthroughs. The House, on mostly party lines, again passed a resolution to end the president's emergency declaration at the southern border that began in February. Only 13 Republicans joined Democrats to end the emergency previously. This time, only 11 did. By virtue of the emergency declaration, President Trump is permitted to use executive authority to divert billions of dollars of already appropriated funds for military construction projects to help pay for a border wall instead of what they were originally designated for. In a series of reports, the Health and Human Services Inspector General urged an improved vetting process for the independent researchers that review grant applications at the National Institutes of Health, because 70% of its $37 billion budget in fiscal year 2018 went to grants for researchers outside of government, and there's growing concern that taxpayer-funded research can end up largely benefiting foreign governments. Such concerns arise out of instances like the one in 2013, when Chinese researchers were charged with stealing research from an NIH-backed university in the U.S. In one of the Inspector General's reports, it found that the NIH had not specifically addressed concerns about foreign threats when it vets peer reviewers of grant applications. Up next, New Hampshire Fiscal Policy Institute policy analyst Phil Sletten will join me to discuss this year's state budget process, reliance upon federal funding, and comparisons between the state and federal budget. We also recently did a joint interactive budget exercise that we will talk about in a little more detail. We'll be back after these short messages. Welcome back to Facing the Future. I'm your host, Chase Hageman. I'm joined on the show by New Hampshire Fiscal Policy Institute policy analyst Phil Sletten. Prior to his work with NHFPI, Phil served as a performance auditor for the New Hampshire Office of Legislative Budget Assistant, where he provided analysis on a wide range of state agency operations. He has a master's from the University of Wisconsin-Madison. He's also born and raised in New Hampshire. He has been on the show before. We discussed state-related budget policy at the time, and he's back again, this time on the fiscal new year. Welcome back to Facing the Future, Phil.
Thanks for having me back, Chase. Happy to be here.
Happy to have you on the show. In fact, we've been working together pretty regularly lately. We've done some budget exercises together. We've had you on the show. And just recently, we did an interactive budget exercise with both state and federal focus with the Concord Young Professionals Network here in Concord, New Hampshire, at the lovely location of Cheers, not to be confused with the television show. So I wanted to have you on today to talk a little bit about that experience, and then there's a whole bevy of other issues related to state and federal budgeting that I want to get to as well. But before we do any of that, maybe for the benefit of our listeners, since I know you pretty well, but they probably do not, can you give a little background on what you do with NHFPI and what your goals are as an organization?
Sure. So the New Hampshire Fiscal Policy Institute is a nonpartisan, nonprofit, independent policy research organization based in Concord, New Hampshire. We look at state budget and revenue and tax policy, as well as the state economy and healthcare policy as well, with an eye towards how it impacts low and moderate income people in the state, or people with pretty limited means, which of course state policy affects everybody. Looking at a little bit of that analysis, or gearing our analysis towards how it affects the swath of the population that's sometimes most profoundly impacted by government policy is where we focus our attention. And one of the things that we do is we provide analysis to the public, to journalists, to legislators about what's going on with these state policies and what some of the implications of some of these policy decisions may be. At the federal level, there's quite a bit of analysis that's done. There's a little less done at the state level. Obviously, it's a smaller population that's being governed, if you will, by the state. There's 1.35 or 1.36 million people in New Hampshire, as opposed to well over 300 million in the United States as a whole. And there's less analysis done of the policies that affect that group.
But we're a very important portion of the population.
Absolutely.
We're the first in the nation primary state. So small but mighty is how I like to think of it. Sorry to interrupt you, Phil.
Absolutely.
<Go ahead.
laughs> No. So one of the things we try to do is try and fill the gaps and try and provide information to help people understand what public policy implications there are for policy choices in New Hampshire and what the state economy looks like, understanding what challenges people are facing out there.
And you mentioned a key phrase in my mind, and that is policy choices. And that takes me right into what I wanted to kick off the show with today, and that is Budget on Tap. Actually, it's the second annual Budget on Tap, where we did a federal budget exercise, and this time a state budget exercise as part of that. The purpose in my mind was not only to engage young professionals on broad fiscal policy issues, but to give them an opportunity to see what it was like to be in the driver's seat on making some of those tough decisions. And that's where the whole idea of policy choices comes into play. We've talked about principles and priorities, which is the federal budget exercise from the Concord Coalition's perspective. And we tweaked it a bit for this particular event. And you created a whole new thing, or at least revamped it based on past work we've done together from a state perspective. So can you give us a little insight as to what the state budget exercise looked like, why you crafted it the way you did, and what you were hoping participants would get out of it?
Sure, absolutely. So the state budget exercise was basically a series of revenue and expenditure options as legislators are facing, and legislators were actually facing up until recently when we decided on a final state budget agreement here in the state. What we did is we pulled a lot of those state budget choices that legislators were actually in the midst of discussing and that were discussed in the last legislative session, and assigned number values to them. So you can increase or decrease revenues, increase or decrease expenditures. Of course, a key component of that being you have to balance the budget. New Hampshire's state operating budget has to balance every 2 years.
Which is not something that you have to do at the federal level or in our exercise.
and is reflected in the exercises. So of course, some of the choices were relatively granular at the state level. $10 million, $17 million decisions.
I think we talked about this evening event, we talked about how the whole state budget is effectively a rounding error relative to the federal budget, which that's not meant to demean New Hampshire. It's just honestly an indication of how large the federal budget is and what kind of numbers we're talking about.
Right. The big numbers in the state budget exercise were, $206 million, $363 million over a 2-year period, whereas, the whole state budget in New Hampshire for a 1-year period is about $6.5 billion. That's not everything the state spends, but is about, you know, the amount that it's in the state budget for each year. Whereas in your exercise, the significant digit was a $1 billion digit, right? You start at the billions of dollars.
I don't even know if we had an option that was as low as $6 billion. And that's in part because we're looking at a 10-year policy window, whereas in the state level, you're looking at a smaller window, correct?
Yes, a two-year window, because we have a biennial budget in New Hampshire where the legislature in the January to June session, and really in February to June, puts together what the state budget is going to look like for the next 2 years. So there's another session that meets in even-numbered years from January to May or June, but that session does not deal directly with crafting a new state budget. The state budget that was set the prior year lasts for a two-year period.
So when you put together this exercise, you mentioned that it tied into things that were going on around the state budget this cycle. So what were some of the issues that you highlighted or you wanted the participants to really get a taste of or grapple with?
Yeah, so some of the key components were education funding, specifically funding for local education. This is primarily a state responsibility in the way that we have the United States set up now. There are certainly federal funds that flow to the states and local governments for education, but they aren't very large, certainly in New Hampshire, relative to the amount of money provided by the state to local governments and what local governments raise and spend themselves on education. So education funding was a big topic in the state of New Hampshire, specifically the education funding formula, how dollars are provided to local governments on a per student basis and what some of those adjustments are. So that was one big topic in the state budget debate that was incorporated into the exercise. Another was Medicaid reimbursement rates, and there's certainly a federal interaction here. Medicaid is a state-federal fiscal partnership that helps that provides health coverage for people with very limited means, people below certain incomes, below certain assets amounts, depending on what part of the program you're looking at. And those were two major expenditure components, as well as some components on the mental health side in particular, some of the mental health physical infrastructure, especially providing spaces for people who are in mental health crisis and getting response teams to them quickly when they are in such a crisis. And the big question also on the state side is, how are we going to fund these priorities? So one of the debates was around business tax rates. Are the business taxes in New Hampshire are particularly important for our state budget? We have two primary business taxes, and they are the largest and fourth largest tax revenue sources for the state. So some of the adjustments to those rates was a big part of the discussion here in New Hampshire during this budget cycle. And also, what other revenue sources would be a component of funding these priorities? Earlier in the budget discussions, there was discussion of expanding the current interest and dividends tax in New Hampshire to include capital gains. All these options, as well as many others, were included in the state budget exercise that these folks at the Concord Young Professionals Network, which is a very good organization locally for connecting folks.
Which you're a member of.
I am a member of, yes. Full disclosure there, they faced a lot of these options. And these options were options that they were, you know, reading about in the news if they were picking up the local paper and seeing what was going on at the state level.
So I'm assuming, Phil, the options you chose for this exercise were a sampling of what the universe of policy options are or budget decisions are at the state level.
Yes, and they also were defined in such a way that, unlike legislators at the state house, they couldn't adjust, you know, for specific tweaks. If you wanted to make something that was $17.5 million costs $8.5 million, you know, legislators have the power to recraft some of those policy proposals. In this exercise, where they had 30 minutes for the state side and 30 minutes for the federal side, we didn't provide them with that option. We said, here's your policy option. You have to either select it or not.
Yeah, and the time limits are what led to, from the federal perspective, the Concord Coalition also providing just a sampling of what members of Congress would have to consider or discuss or debate at the federal level. So the two sides of the exercise were very similar in that regard. And I think because of that sampling, we often have to package different policy options together, you know, several options maybe related to healthcare or Social Security or tax reform or particular areas of investment. Did you have anything like that in the state exercise, or overall, did you get a feel or a sense for whether the young professionals enjoyed those particular options that you presented before them?
Right. So I think that one of the components, because if you're going to increase expenditures, you have to increase revenues, and if you're going to decrease revenues, you have to forego some investments on the expenditure side. One of the things that you saw in part of the results of these budget exercises, or what the groups ended up deciding on, is that if they wanted to fund a certain priority, especially one of the larger dollar value item priorities, they had to make some decisions about, what sort of taxes you're going to increase, what sort of revenue you're going to collect. And that, I think, led to some of the discussions being relatively in-depth about some of the trade-offs of some of these priorities. So some of the options were relatively granular, but it also did present people with sort of choices around, okay, if we're going to balance this budget, how are we going to do it? And, some groups started with revenue, some groups started with expenditures. The budget, the nice thing as part of this exercise for them is the budget came balanced. So really, if they wanted to add expenditures, then they had to worry about adding revenues, or if they added revenues, then they had more expenditure options. So they had a little bit of flexibility on that front. But at the same time, I believe that there were certain instances where they wanted to find some sort of either halfway component or amended component, or some of the options did interact with each other. And I did see some discussion over, well, perhaps we could do this part of this option and not this part of this option, which, of course, affects the outcomes, affects the dollar figures in your balanced budget.
Phil, with all of that in mind, you mentioned that the way the exercise was structured, that it came already balanced, and basically whatever decision they made on the spending or revenue side would dictate what they'd have to do moving forward. Similarly, the federal exercise is sort of a status quo budget. If you say no to a particular policy option, or if you don't even engage in the exercise, the existing policies just continue to go as already existing, already written into law, or already approved by Congress. And in the exercise with SIPIN, the Concord Young Professionals Network, I found on the federal side that all the groups were able to, at least in some capacity, reduce federal budget deficits. I think the range was anywhere from around $1 trillion over 10 years to over $5 trillion in reductions over 10 years, which to me was pretty amazing, because I had constructed the exercise in such a way that was pretty much maxing out. But when you take it back to the big picture, federal budget deficits are expected to grow over the next 10 years for a total of over $12 trillion. So the way the federal exercise was constructed, you couldn't even balance the budget. It was more about getting us on a more long-term, sustainable track. And obviously, in the state exercise, you want things to balance. But did anyone have any surpluses?
Yes, there were absolutely surpluses, sometimes pretty significant ones. All of them were in the tens of millions of dollars, which on the on the state side is a relatively large surplus at the end of balancing a budget. Oftentimes, legislators, when they're balancing the budget, will leave single-digit millions of dollars at the end of their state budget plans. So having tens of millions of dollars remaining meant that there were some options that probably could have been selected on the expenditure side, or some revenue changes that could have been made that weren't in the state budget exercise. One other thing to note is that the state budget exercise, the state budgeters, they are dealing with just the operating budget. The state does have debt, right? Not everything in the balance in the budget balances over a two-year period in the state operating budget, it does. But for the state as a whole, there is debt associated with certain transportation projects, for example, certain capital projects. There are separate documents. There are separate sort of legislative authorities for that. There's the 10-year transportation improvement plan, and there's the state capital budget, which is a six-year budget that's updated every 2 years. So these folks were just dealing with the two-year operating budget, which has to balance, and all of them had pretty significant surpluses.
Yeah, to me that sounds a little bit like, again, federal level. Congress only gets to play with about a third of the overall budget at this point because of things like mandatory spending or interest on the debt that are eclipsing other parts of the budget. So your policymakers and my policymakers in this exercise were dealing with a smaller universe than just, I would say, the broad fiscal policies at the state and federal level.
Well, and absolutely. And there were some trends that were pretty interesting in terms of what was common across the groups. One is among the Concord Young professionals who were there, if you will, they all raised aid for local public education in property poor school districts and districts with more low income students. That was one of the most expensive options on the expenditure side, and they all funded it. They all paid to fix structurally deficient bridges. They all added an adult dental benefit to Medicaid, which New Hampshire does not currently have. They all opted to reduce funding for travel and tourism development and promotion in the state. And not all, but some added money to the university system or to the state's affordable housing fund. Although I'll note some groups, ran out of time. I did hear from one group that said we have more surplus than we've picked expenditures for, and we've run out of time to make some of those decisions. Which in a legislative timeline, sometimes you do run out of time. In terms of paying for those items, everyone increased taxes on cigarettes, increased the tobacco tax. Everyone expanded the tobacco tax to include vaping products, which was an option. And again, something that's part of the legislature's budget package. Also, everyone expanded the New Hampshire interest and dividends tax to include capital gains, which aren't currently taxed in New Hampshire. Everyone raised the beer tax. And perhaps
I was very disappointed by that.
and on the housing related front, one group did lower the real estate transfer tax, which does affect the price of a home purchase in terms of out of pocket costs for folks. So that's some of the themes that I saw across these groups. And there were some variation among the groups, obviously, at some of the smaller items, but those were some of the interesting themes across.
Yeah, and I think, Phil, to your point, there are usually themes that I see, even at the federal level, budget exercise, depending on the group that I'm working with, whether it's a group of retirees or a group of young professionals or a group of high school students. There tend to be sort of these almost social priorities that bleed through at least the discussion, maybe not the final decision of the group because, to our credit, we structure it in such a way that, majority rules in terms of selecting a particular policy option, and they have to find ways to compromise or have to find areas of common ground. But by and large, I do see, as you pointed out, some pretty consistent themes when doing these exercises with a whole variety of groups. So it'll be really interesting to see how up-and-coming generations want to tackle these issues and what they decide their priorities will be. If they have the room to actually set priorities, and that'll be a dilemma they'll have to deal with as well. This is Facing the Future. I'm Chase Hageman. I'm talking to NHFPI policy analyst Phil Slutton. We're discussing an interactive state and federal budget exercise, and we're about to start talking about the state and federal budget process, as well as the state's reliance upon federal funding, and comparing the state and federal budgets just a little bit here, Phil. And let's get right into that. You started talking about what the state budget process is like. How has this year been different than past years?
Right. So what usually happens with the state budget process is you have state agencies build a version of their budget and request that, submit those as public budget requests. And the governor, and that's takes place in the summer of an even numbered year. And so every even-numbered year, it's a two-year budget, and about halfway through that two-year budget, the state agencies start preparing for the next budget. So they produce a request. There are different tiers of request, one larger one and one smaller one. And then the governor takes those requests and forms his or her budget proposal out of those requests and any other priorities the governor may have and want to include in his or her budget. That budget is then proposed in February to the legislature. It first goes to the House, and a version of the budget passes through the House generally. That doesn't always happen. It didn't happen not this cycle, but the cycle before. But generally, the House passes its version of the budget. The Senate then takes up that version that passed from the House to the Senate and makes its own modifications if it so desires. And the Senate and House, if they have different versions, will then go to Committee of Conference. And that Committee of Conference is a group of selected legislators from the House and the Senate And they pound out, if you will, they agree on a budget compromise that then has to pass through both chambers before going to the governor for signature or veto, or in some cases, the governor can allow the budget to pass without a signature or have it not become law without a signature, depending on timing.
That sounds pretty familiar in terms of what the federal process is supposed to look like. And I say supposed to because I don't think it's actually gone through the official process in its entirety ever since, you know, it was defined in, I think, 1974. It's gone through different iterations or experienced different delays, so they had to hit fast forward on certain parts of it. But by and large, the way it's supposed to work is similar to what you just outlined from the state perspective. How has this year been different than what the norm has been at the state level or how things should go?
Right. So this year was different because the legislature made some changes to the governor's budget proposal, which is typical. Usually there are changes in the process. The legislature made some relatively substantial changes and did bring some of those changes back, roll some of those changes back as part of the legislative process. The governor did veto the budget at the end of June. And July 1st is the beginning of the new state fiscal year, unlike the federal fiscal year, which is October 1st.
Well, you just passed a new budget, so we're kind of like oddly lining up this year.
Right, absolutely. So there was a three-month continuing resolution, and continuing resolution isn't the official name in New Hampshire, but it's what it's understood as, and that reflects some of the discussion of how budgets are funded at the federal level. So that continuing resolution lasted 3 months, which means that it would have expired on October 1st if there weren't a new budget passed.
Happy New Year.
right, absolutely. On September 25th, however, the legislature did pass a budget compromise that was produced the prior day by announced by some legislative leadership who were in budget negotiations and the governor. So that budget is now the budget for the next 1¾ years. But prior to that, we were running on a continuing resolution that was based on state fiscal year 19. So, you know, prior to June 30th of this calendar year, those expenditure levels. And there were some tweaks that were made during the process to fund certain priorities, but it did create a constraint for state agencies and, you know, meant that there had to be sort of special provisions to accept certain federal funds and other, you know, other projects and other other contracts were, you know, delayed in some cases. So that continuing resolution being funded at those prior year levels did have an impact on the state's operations.
And Phil, I know CR is not the official name for what happens at the state level, but I hear continuing resolution or CR at the federal level almost every month at this point because, you know, in any given fiscal year at the federal level, you could see 1, 2, 3 continuing resolutions on different parts of discretionary spending just to get the government by until an overall deal is struck and the appropriations process is completed. How often does that happen at the state level in terms of having to utilize something like a continuing resolution?
Right. So there was one as recently as 2015. Obviously, we had one this year. And in 2015, there was also another gubernatorial veto that triggered a continuing resolution. There was also a gubernatorial veto of the budget in 2003. Prior to that, though, was 1977. And I believe 71 and then a couple times in the 50s were the instances of there being a stopgap needed to fill a place where there was not spending authority by the state government through the state budget.
So that's amazing because we went decades without having to do any kind of stopgap measure, which means in my mind that would communicate the message that our voters don't like CRs, that they don't like a system that breaks down, that they like having a biennial process with a, you know, an aim at a balanced budget and having regular order. Is that the case?
It's certainly outside of the norm to have a continuing resolution, and it does create some specific challenges that state agencies and legislators aren't typically accustomed to incorporating into the process. One of the things that's different from the federal level and at the state level is that we're dealing with a 2-year budget as opposed to a 1-year budget at the federal level. So while there's quite
don't
a bit...
Don't even get me started on needing a biennial budget at the federal level, Phil.
Well, there's more money that the federal level has to deal with, maybe more decisions that have to be made and a more compressed timeline. Uh-huh. So I think that certainly the continuing resolution created quite a few specific challenges that that in a normal budget process, I think most folks would prefer to avoid because some of them are unforeseen. It's a 3-month continuing resolution based on 3 months of the prior year's budget. state agencies, not every state agency spends the same amount each month. If they have a year of a budget, then they're able to say, okay, let's move the dollars around within that year in that budget line as we need to. But if they only have 3 months and July, August, and September are their higher expenditure months for the year, that creates a particular challenge for them because it means they have to go and ask for a specific appropriation or additional authority to spend dollars. And that's then another thing that they're spending time doing as opposed to spending time on their and resources on their normal operations and getting services to the people of New Hampshire.
Phil, let's switch gears a little bit to crossover between the state and federal government. What level of funding, how much funding does the state of New Hampshire need from the federal government to meet its own obligations, or how much revenue does it welcome into the system so that it can, you know, expand programs like Medicaid? Can you give us a bit of a rundown of where that interaction occurs?
Sure. So looking just at the state budget, and again, the state budget doesn't include all state expenditures, but looking just at the state budget, federal funds fund about 30% directly. So, and there's some significant operations, including expanded Medicaid in the state under the Granted Advantage Healthcare Program, that, you know, a lot of the money, or the vast majority of the dollars in that program, come from the federal government. So think about it as about $1 in $3 that are spent on state operations come from the federal government in some form or another, usually through transfers that are designed for specific programs or part of specific programs and designed for specific purposes. So a 1 in 3 is a rough number, but a large portion of that is the Medicaid program. The Medicaid program in New Hampshire is the largest single program. It's a little over $2 billion of expenditures. Remember, every year our state budget is about $6.5 billion. So $2 billion relative to that. Not all of it's in the state budget, but it's a large program, and it provides health coverage for about 175,000 people in the state.
Is that a number that's grown over the years as Medicaid has been expanded, or is that percentage has that held relatively flat over the last several decades?
So over several decades, if we're talking about healthcare expenditures, the cost of most everything has gone up. And that's because, not just because of the program expanding, but also because of costs in the healthcare industry as a whole. Certainly at the state level, if you look over the last decade, expanded Medicaid in New Hampshire has been a pretty significant increase in the number of people enrolled, as well as the expenditures in the program. In the last several years, because of some changes to the program and because of Medicaid enrollments trending in some cases a downward direction because of the improving economy and perhaps other factors as well, the Medicaid expenditures over the last several years haven't gone up, and there have been some, in terms of that $2 billion figure overall, they haven't gone up dramatically. They've been hovering around that $2 billion figure over the last several years. That being said, one of the things about the Medicaid program that makes it a powerful counter-cyclical program is that if there were to be a recession, and this is what I mean by counter-cyclical, I'm talking about economic cycles, if there were to be a recession, more people would lose their jobs, more people would have little or no income, right? Lose their incomes entirely if they lose their jobs, then Medicaid is responsive to that and allows people to continue to have health coverage so that if they were to have a health crisis, there would at least be some coverage that they could receive through the Medicaid program. So if there were to be a recession, for example, or there were to be a less favorable economic environment, that means that, and even at a community level, right? If a large facility that employs a lot of people closes suddenly, that's a place where the Medicaid program would step in and enrollment would increase, but it would provide supports for those folks who otherwise may not be able to access healthcare services.
Phil, what are some of the other areas or programs that are impacted by federal revenues or funding or experience a jolt of additional funding coming in from the federal level? I'm thinking of, you know, infrastructure projects where roads and bridges are being built, and there's probably grants or additional revenues that are, you know, some kind of cost sharing mechanism with the state and federal government. You know, are there things like that that New Hampshire relies upon, and what other areas do you see a benefit from?
Sure, absolutely. So, you mentioned the match. Medicaid is a matched program, so most of Medicaid is a dollar-for-dollar match. So, meaning the state puts in a dollar, the federal government puts in a dollar, and those $2 then go to provide health coverage for folks in the state. On the transportation side, there are a fair number of matching programs as well as grants. And the transportation side has a wide variety of programs. There's a pretty large array of programs as opposed to some of the complexity that's in the Medicaid program, but it's still all under the Medicaid umbrella. So federal transportation aid is the next largest portion of that. And some of that does have a match. Some of those matches are quite favorable, like 80-20, for example, where the state puts in 20% and the federal government puts in 80%. SNAP, which is the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, still known as the Food Stamps Program in New Hampshire, which is its older name at the federal level from back several decades ago. All of the benefits for that come from the federal government. So all the benefits are paid for by the federal government. And if I recall, that's about 80,000 people in the state that are covered by that. And about 40% of them are children. So there are a fair number of those benefits. The administrative costs are split roughly 50-50, but the benefits are paid for by the federal government. Temporary assistance for needy families is prior to 1996, was called welfare at the federal level. That is a block grant that's provided by the federal government to accomplish certain temporary assistance for needy families related goals in the state, including, providing supports for people who are very low incomes. One more that I'll mention is, because it's getting to be that time of year, is the LIHEAP program, the Low Income Home Energy Assistance Program. That's funded federally and funds the state fuel assistance program. That helps with heating and cooling in terms of providing assistance for low-income folks who need to heat or cool their homes for them to be comfortable and livable. Again, it's October in New Hampshire, so we're thinking about those folks who may have trouble paying their heating bills each year. Those are federally funded. There are other programs like veterans aid certain education aid, certain grants associated with clean and drinking water that come into the state that are pretty significant in terms of protecting our water supply. So there's a lot of federal interaction with the state level. That's not atypical. New Hampshire being about 30% of its budget being federal funds, that's not an atypical number. A lot of states, especially states with a lot of Medicaid enrollees, have a fairly substantial portion of their funding come from the federal government.
Yeah, if I remember correctly, it's a pretty wide range of percentages. And New Hampshire actually falls, I think, middle or lower tier in terms of how much they rely on federal government revenues relative to other states.
And that's about right, based on the rankings that I've seen as well. It's because there are some states that have a more favorable Medicaid match baked in, for example, and other states that relative to the amount of revenue they collect, use a relatively small fund a relatively small portion of their budgets through the federal government.
But it's still safe to it would still be safe to say that whatever policy decisions are made at the federal level could certainly have an impact directly on New Hampshire with the programs that we're utilizing, those matching of funds. And then I look at things like the tax code at the federal level and the reforms that took place in 2017. And this is a huge topic in of itself, and we only have a couple more minutes. So if you could give us a quick snapshot of maybe how the recent tax reform impacted the state, and I think it factored into this year's budget process a little bit, so maybe you can tie it in there as well.
Absolutely. That's probably the biggest impact. And, remember, Medicaid reimbursement rates were a big part of the discussion here at the state level, but the big impact that we were seeing in terms of what's happening to our state revenues and how that impacts our budget decisions stemmed in large part from the Federal Tax Cuts and Jobs Act that passed in late December of 2017, that federal tax overhaul. Now, New Hampshire, unlike a lot of other states, New Hampshire didn't have any provisions that automatically changed. So there were many states that saw automatic changes because their tax codes in some way or another were tied to the federal tax code. New Hampshire didn't see automatic changes in that way, to that extent. However, we did see a large influx of revenue, in part because of the provisions that affect multinational businesses. New Hampshire, I mentioned earlier, New Hampshire relies on, at the state level, on business tax revenue from the business profits tax and the business enterprise tax, which are our largest and fourth largest revenue sources for the state in terms of tax revenue. And those taxes saw an increase in state fiscal 18, which includes that December 2017 overhaul, saw an increase of 22.5% over the prior year. And when you're talking about large tax revenue sources for the state, that's a pretty significant impact on the budget. We also saw a 5% increase roughly in the preliminary 19 numbers over 18. But what we're starting to see now is that those numbers are going down. Mm. We're starting to see the revenue from those business taxes sort of tail off. And that's not what you expect to see when you're building a state budget, right? You expect to see revenues grow up a little bit and you can have expenditures grow a little bit with that because of inflationary pressures, especially especially on healthcare and things like, and transportation costs and that sort of thing, transportation infrastructure costs. So seeing revenues tail down and being projected to drop further over the course of the biennium presented sort of a unique challenge for state budgeters in this session. And a lot of that, again, stems from that influx of revenue affecting multinational businesses that were repatriating dollars from overseas, responding to the federal tax code changes. And while New Hampshire's tax code didn't change, right? New Hampshire's tax, they did make some modifications in the final state budget agreement, but New Hampshire's tax code didn't change, meaning that those repatriated dollars, those ones that were actually brought back, were captured in New Hampshire's state business profits tax base. And that affected our state revenues in a very significant one-time fashion, as well as mergers and acquisitions and other activity that was spurred by the federal tax overhaul. So it's going to have a, it's had a pretty profound impact on how New Hampshire has decided to budget.
Well, as always, Phil, I enjoy our conversations because they're always incredibly insightful. Obviously, I focus on federal budget policy in my day job and in our work with the Concord Coalition. So it's nice to see a glimpse of what it's like at the state level where you have an incredible level of expertise. This is Facing the Future. I'm your host, Chase Hageman. You've been listening to me and New Hampshire Fiscal Policy Institute policy analyst Phil Sletten. We discussed interactive budget exercises, state budget process, federal budget process, as well as the interaction between the state and federal budgets, and really the realization that we're all in this together. So whatever policies are happening at the federal level can certainly have a dramatic impact on what's going on for us here locally. Thank you for joining the show once again, Phil.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me, Chase.
We'll be back after these short messages for our final segment, Facing the Facts. Welcome back to Facing the Future. I'm your host, Chase Hageman, and this is our final segment, Facing the Facts, where I share with you a fact or a piece of information that I think is worth you pondering until next week's show. So, it's time to face this fact. Presidential candidates should be discussing fiscal policy issues in more detail. Voters should be demanding more specific answers, and the Concord Coalition has a plan for that. Or, you know, we have a document that lays out the issues and suggests questions. It is called the 2020 Presidential Election Issue Guide, and you can find it on our website, ConcordCoalition.org. But today I'll give you a taste of the goodness inside that issue guide. In the months ahead, presidential candidates will make many promises and offer ambitious economic plans, but within weeks of taking office, the next president will have to fit these plans into a proposed budget to submit to Congress. With nonpartisan budget projections showing an unsustainable path under current laws, it is critical for whoever is elected president in 2020 to chart a more responsible and sustainable fiscal course. Presidential candidates should therefore explain how they would do that or explain why they would not. The national debt and related federal budget issues are rife with myths and misinformation, often amplified by candidates and others during campaigns. Voters have a right and a responsibility to ask how the candidates plan to put the nation on a more responsible fiscal path and to find out whether their plans are based on factual analysis. This guide is intended to serve as a nonpartisan resource to voters, media, and candidates on these issues. First and foremost, we encourage all candidates to answer this question, and obviously voters need to ask it. If you are elected president, what will you do to address the national debt? Consider this. The gross national debt is now more than $22 trillion. That equates to about $173,000 per American household. The gross debt is comprised of debt held by the public, which is what the government owes to its outside creditors, such as those who purchase government bonds, and intergovernmental debt, which is what the government owes to its own trust funds, such as the Social Security and Medicare trust funds. Debt held by the public is $16 trillion, or 78% of GDP. The intergovernmental debt is nearly $6 trillion. Because debt held by the public is bought and sold on the open market and helps determine interest rates, most economists think debt held by the public is a better measure of a country's exposure than gross debt. Debt held by the public is projected to grow by more than $12 trillion over the next 10 years. And as a share of GDP, it is projected to reach a level higher than it was in the immediate aftermath of World War II, its largest level in history, by the mid-2030s. This is not because another war or economic depression is anticipated. Projections assume a continuously growing economy and no major foreign wars, yet the debt is still projected to skyrocket. The problem is a structural mismatch built into current law. I'll leave it there for now because, frankly, the issue guide is a better read, and there's plenty more that is covered, like the leading drivers of the debt, healthcare, taxes, and critical investments. Go to ConcordCoalition.org to learn more, but I'll leave you with this. Help make the debt a top issue in 2020. Ask candidates to, one, acknowledge that the growing debt is a serious problem, two, make dealing with the debt a top policy priority in their campaigns, three, put forward a plan for what they would do, not what they would refuse to do, four, explain how they would pay for their policy initiatives, and five, and finally, use their platforms to engage and educate the public about the tough choices in order to prepare for action once in office. You've been Facing the Future. I'm Chase Hageman. Thanks for listening.